advice from Paul that when it comes to looking ahead, it's important to also look behind. He talks about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He says in verse 1, I will not have you be ignorant that all our fathers wandered the cloud and all passed through the sea. They were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they ate the same spiritual meat. They all drank of the same spiritual drink. For they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. And as then I indicate, verse 6, now these things were our examples, to the intent we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. The Israelites, while led by Christ, were not always a godly people. And we find that today in our society too. We claim to be a Christian society, but our people, our nation, are far from godly. As we watch what is happening in Washington, D.C., politics does not show love and outgoing concern. There are so many examples of that. But it is important for us always to remember you can learn from looking behind to know what you should be doing that is in the future. When you watch kids on their bikes in the street in front of your house, sometimes they'll set up a little ramp, a little jump, and they'll start jumping and having fun out there. Our kids did that when they were younger. And the older kids always did it first. And it was amazing when the littler ones would start doing it, that they would jump further and better than their older siblings. Why? Because they learned as they watched older brothers and sisters jump. They found what they could do that was better. And so it is so many times in life. The younger ones learn from the bravado and the stupidity of the bigger, older ones. And there's been some stupidity before us, and I want you to maintain an understanding of what's gone before and to know what your forefathers in Israel did and even our forefathers in the last few decades have done. It's important for us to be satisfying our great God. We do live in a very unruly society. This last week, we had a lot of firecrackers in the neighborhood. The sheriff got involved, and they went on for 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of a week ago. And we did our routine going to Fort Lauderdale and came home Sabbath evening. I went to bed. Joy was reading a book, and somebody threw something at the front door. And the fireworks were going off outside, and she was in her night clothes, so she didn't go bother to get find out what it was. But in the morning when we awoke, we found out that somebody hadn't thrown a firecracker at the front door. They'd thrown a rock through the skylight above the door. And we had been complaining about the fireworks, and so I guess I was marked. Literally. I called the sheriff. He came over, did his report. We had a lively discussion. And once he found out of my occupation, and we talked a little bit about some things similar, and he said to me, well, the Bible talks about times like these, doesn't it? And he was true in that. And I don't want your children following that example. You don't. You want your children well behaved. Goes on in these verses. Considering again verse 6, what happened before are for our examples. He says, so don't be idolaters as they were sometimes. As is written, the people sat down to eat and drank and rose up to play. 8, neither let us commit fornication. Now some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of the serpents. It's an important thought to put on that these people at that time were tempting Christ during the time of the Exodus. And the serpents that came after them, and they found themselves that victimized by snakes, destroyed of serpents, becomes a symbolic of what happens to us because the serpent sometimes chases us. And then in 10, neither murmur you as some of them murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer. So when we look at these verses, don't be idolaters, you must not be fornicators, do not tempt Christ, and fourthly, don't murmur. Verses 7, 8, 9, and 10 mention four specific things to avoid that the Israelites went through and become bad examples for us. Now, in the following days, coming through the days of unleavened bread, more than likely that will be discussed in detail. It's important that the speakers give meat in due season, and I hope that one of them will take to the position of going through these things in detail and just reading the story. They're for our edification. And those stories can help you see yourself as you examine your own life in depth, as you maybe would see particular spiritual parallels. It is important that you apply lessons. I want to apply some of the lessons that can be learned from these things of our forefathers by going through a section of 2 Kings. In 2 Kings, there's a story after story after story about your forefathers, my forefathers, the Israelites, and how they slapped Christ in the face. They tempted, they murmured, they starved, they hurt, they had pain. People died horribly because they would not acknowledge these four points. They were idolaters, fornicators, tempting Christ and murmuring. There's many examples of it, but I found it personally interesting. And this is because of my background. When I was a young boy, my dad challenged me to read the Bible. Chuck, you're not reading the Bible much. And I said, well, it's not very interesting. He says, well, read the stuff about all the battles that they used to have. Read about the wars. And I started reading that, and it was interesting to me. And as some of those wars, then, I want you to consider in 2 Kings 6, in verse 24, came to pass that after this, that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, and there's still a king of Syria, still a leader in Syria next door to the physical nation of Israel today, well, he went up and besieged Samaria. That is the capital of the northern kingdoms. He went to the area north of Jerusalem, in that great valley area of the Jordan River, and he set siege. And so then there was a famine in that area of Samaria caused by Syria. Now, in some ways, there's a particular parallel there, because there is a siege, as it were, laid on the borders there between Syria and Israel today. And it was so bad that an ass's head was sold for 40 pieces of silver and a fourth part of a cap of dung from a dove for 5 pieces of silver. They were starving so much that they would eat donkey heads and boil them. That's what happened to that nation, who were the keepers of God's law, who were introduced to a relationship with Him, as you heard in the first message. They forgot all about that, forgot about obedience. And the king was watching all of this. And as he was passing upon the wall, there cried a woman to him, "Help me, my lord, O king." And he said, "If the Lord does not help you, when shall I help you? If God can't help you, what am I going to be doing? Can I give you something out of the barn or out of the wine press? What ails you?" And she answered, "Well, a woman, a neighbor, said, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son, and we did eat him. And I said unto her on the next day, well, give your son that we may eat him. And she has hid her son." Became so destitute, they were eating their own children. Now, this is what happens when people break away from keeping the laws of God. They do devilish things. Most of you have children. Can you imagine taking a 2 or 3 year old, slitting its throat, cleaning it, and putting it in a pot to boil? That's what was happening, because people abandoned the laws of God. Now today, you can learn about that. That time could come to our nation again. Whether or not you learn the lesson is depending on what you happen to learn today. As a parent taking care of children, as you prepare sons and daughters, realize they're really owned by God. That they're lent to you for guiding and maturing. A lot of us have children that are now grown. They've developed. We need to teach those children the best we can these principles. Safety was offered to some in these very difficult times. In the next chapter, going to chapter 8, Elisha is on the scene. And if you want to fill in some good reading, start with the first chapter of this 2 Kings and read about Elisha and the things that he did. "Then spoke Elisha to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, arise, go you in your house and stay wherever you can stay, for the Lord has called for a famine. It will come upon the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did after the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and lived in the land of the Philistines for 7 years. It came to pass at the end of the 7 years that the woman returned out of the land of the Philistines, and she went forth to cry to the king for her house and for her land." So she wanted what had been hers returned. While the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, he says, "Well, would you review for me the great things that Elisha has done?" And it came to pass, as he was telling the king how that Elisha had restored a dead body to life, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life cried to the king for her house and for her land. So she comes back after 7 years, and it just so happens that Gehazi is telling the story about the woman to the king at the very same time. And so when we see the story continue, she cried to the king for her house and for her land, and Gehazi said, "Ah, my lord king, that's the woman. This is her son, whom Elisha restored to life." And as I maybe have remembered to you, could have been Habakkuk was possibly the son that is referred to here, who wrote the Minor Prophet. And when the king asked the woman, and she told him, so the king appointed unto her a certain officer. He said, "Restore all the things that were hers and all the fruits of the field since that day that she left the land even unto now." And Elisha came to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. And the man was told him, saying, "The man of God is here." And the king said unto Hazael, "Take a present in your hand to meet him. Inquire, am I going to recover from my disease?" You see, that safety was offered to God's own. In the story here is this widow who had her son restored to life, and she hugged him and was so glad of that. It makes you wonder. 7 years from now, who will remember you hugging the ways of God? We live in a time where things could tilt so quickly. We live in a time when our nation is on the precipice of tremendous default. We've already defaulted morally and socially. Financially, we're on the edge. When we went through our problem a couple years ago, it was said it was so terrible that we were within half a day of ATMs not having any cash. Now we print it, and it has no value. My wife will not buy me certain things to eat that I really like. You see, some of them have been altered, genetically altered. And some of those genetically altered things are fed to the animals and the fish we eat. What will it do to your body? Well, I'm 60-something. It maybe doesn't really matter, but the principle matters. What do we breathe? What do we eat? Are we known as godly people without becoming rampant and rabid about these things? Does our example speak? 7 years from now, will our neighbors remember, those were good people? Will there be anybody like Gehazi that can stand and explain what you believed? Well, this man that is wondering if he's going to live finally talks to the king, or to Elisha, gifts traded and so on and so forth. And so, as the story goes in 13, Hazael said, "But what is the servant? Is your servant a dog that he should do this great thing?" And Elisha said, The Lord has showed me that you will be king over Syria. So while Ben-Hadad was the king, Elisha on the scene says to this man, Haziel, who's, some say the name means the son of a nobody, and that's who he was, the son of a nobody. He just came on the scene. He departed from Elisha and came to his master, and he says, well, what did Elisha say? He says, well, he told me that you would recover. And it came to pass on the morrow that he took a thick cloth, dipped it in water, and spread it on his face, so that he died, and Haziel reigned in his stead. He smothered the king so he could have position. Do you ever smother the king? Now you can read it just as a small little story in yada, 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 terrible times, but look at the spiritual principle. Do you in this time smother the king? Now we're preparing for Passover. Does the king live in us or do we smother him? Do we take out a big heavy rug, soak it in water, and throw it over the face of Christ so we don't have to remember what we should be doing? Trying to hide, as it were, from him. The comment from Paul was, be very careful not to tempt Christ. Avoiding the breath of Christ and smothering him may result in him putting the serpent in your path for your own destruction. That's what it says happened to your forefathers, to the Israelites. They would not live it the right way. They tempted Christ to go their way. They smothered the image that they should be following, and snakes followed them. A thick blanket of self-destruction for self-survival will not stop the breath of the king. So when we take the Passover and we think about our own evaluation, remember who is your king. Remember to repent and to kneel before your king. And that your attitude is always one of preparation to be his servant. Because all around us is a way of life, and it's quickly coming to its head, that is not at all godly. Some nations somewhere are now sacrificing children. It happens in Africa. I read to you some months ago how they are crucifying children. It doesn't make the news a lot, but it happens. There was a time in Europe where ungodly, unsightly things happened in those ghettos. I don't want to know about them. But there is the illustration in the Bible that there's going to be captivity, and we could have our own ghettos. Now, if we go to 2 Kings Chapter 9. Elisha the prophet called on one of the children of the prophets and said, now here you're a young student here, you're learning of the right ways. I want you to put your clothes on. Take this box of oil in your hand and go to Ramoth-Gilead. And when you come there, look out for Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi. Go in and make him arise. Excuse me. Make him rise up from among his brethren and carry him to an inner chamber. Then take the box of oil and pour it on his head and say, Thus says the Lord, I have anointed you king over Israel. As compared to the house of Judah, he's going to be king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not. It's like going into that house, do your stuff, and get away because something could happen. So he did that. And the people want to know, well, what did this young man say to you there in private? In the midst of verse 5, he says, Jehu says, Unto which of all of us? And he said, To you, O captain. And he rose and went into the house, and he poured the oil on his head and said to him, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. We are God's people. And you are to smite the house of Ahab your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants the prophets and the blood of all the servants of the Lord at the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. I will cut off Ahab from him that pisses against the wall. All these brave yahoos that dangle in front of the public that they can paint the wall with their pee. Well, I want you to make sure they're all dead. And I will make the house of Ahab like the house of Jeroboam, the house of Nebat, and like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah. And the dog shall eat Jezebel in the portion of Jezreel, and there shall be none to bury her. He opened the door and fled. Well, as the story goes on, and it's an interesting read, I'm going to move to verse 21. Jehoram said, Make ready, and his chariot was made ready, and he, king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, went out, each in his chariot, and they went out against Jehu. And they met him in the portion of Naboth. Came to pass when Joram saw Jehu that he said, Is it peace, Jehu? And Jehu said, What peace, so long as the whoredoms of the mother of Jezebel and her witchcrafts are so many? And Joram turned his hands and fled and said unto Ahaziah, There is treachery, Ahaziah. And Jehu then drew a bow and with his full strength smote Jehoram between the arms, and the arrow went all out his heart, and he sank down in his chariot. So there's war starting. We live in a time where we could enjoy and say that there is peace. But it's a route ready to become undone. We're decreasing the size of our peacemakers. Carrying a big stick is going by the board. But that is how you rule in the ways of man. But for some reason, our leadership, which is let to do their job by our Almighty, are whittling on the stick, and it's becoming smaller and smaller. The story is really interesting as you go through chapter 9. I'm going to move to the end of the chapter, verse 30. And when Jehu was come to Jezreel, Jezebel heard of it, Well, she painted her face, put up her hair, and looked out at a window. So she dolled herself up. She was going to try to entertain this Jehu, who had already talked words about her end and killing her. Well, he entered into the gate, and she said, "Has Zimri peace, who slew his master?" He lifted up his face to the window and said, "Well, is there anyone up there on my side?" Well, two or three eunuchs looked out the window and said, "Yeah, we're with you, Jehu." And they said, "Okay, throw her out." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trod her underfoot. And when he was come in, he did eat and drink and said, "Go now, see this cursed woman and bury her." First indeed, she was the daughter of the king. So they went out to bury her, but they found no more of her except her skull, feet, and palms of her hands. So it came to be true that the word of the Lord was absolutely correct, that when he spoke about it from Elijah, "In the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, 'This is Jezebel.'" Well, in chapter 10, he does many other things. He beheads people. In fact, if you look in verse 7, he took the notice of who the king's sons were, the king of Ahab, King Ahab. He slew 70 people, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jezreel. In verse 14, he slew 42 other men. Then he feigns in the ending parts of the chapter that he really represents Baal. And he puts on the clothes, goes in the temple, and says, "Let's get all the Baal worshippers together from the whole nation." And so they all gather into the temple, and he leaves. And he has his army people outside. He tells his men, "Kill them all that are in there. All of them must be dead, and if you don't kill them, I'll have you killed." A very bloody man. It says in 31 of that chapter 10, "Jehu took no heed to walk in the laws of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart. He departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, which made Israel to sin." So he was not a godly man, but he was fulfilling what God had told him to do. And it's important for you and I to remember that that has happened before. It happened in the days of Daniel. It happened in the days of Isaiah. It happened in the days of Jeremiah. Men have been established by God and inspired to try to set his nation right. We represent the nation of God. And we must be set right as we come to this Passover season. Jehu's slaughters were like a machine in motion. No one stepped in his way except they became a corpse. He furiously attacked his bloody work. He was intrepid, relentless, pitiless in his destruction of Baal worshippers, false worshippers. I found in Halley's Bible Handbook one little quote: "God sometimes uses people and nations that are far from what they ought to be to execute his judgments on the wicked." Now here we are, striving to be genuine in our Passover season. We were reading, as we come to some concluding thoughts, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And how these things should be our examples, that we learn from them, that we understand that we should not be involved with idolatry like our forefathers. But we should not commit fornication. We shouldn't go to bed with false ideas. We shouldn't tempt Christ, and we shouldn't complain. All of which we do. So it's time that we straighten up, isn't it? And maybe you don't do it in the physical sense, but consider the spiritual application. So turn the page with me, please, to 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 11. We've been reading how not to be idolaters, fornicators, haters of Christ, and murmuring. We see that that is what happened so often in the past. It says, before we turn the page, in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12, "Let him that thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. There is no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that which you're able, but with the temptation will make a way to escape, so then you can bear it. Wherefore, my dearly beloved, flee from idolatry." So indeed, while you're tempted and you find difficulty, there's a way of escape. And it might be the escape that even Christ went through. It might be the escape of death. But now turning the page to 11, it says in 23, "That which I received of the Lord I deliver to you, that the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread. He said, 'Take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And he took the cup and supped, saying, 'This cup is my New Testament, is the New Testament in my blood. Drink it in remembrance of me.' So as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." Now as we go about then the business of proclaiming that we are Christian and that we're different than the age and nation and people around us, then we're doing it properly. But if we don't, it says we could be guilty of the body and the blood of Christ. So you must examine yourself. And when you look around the nation, and you look around the neighborhood, I have to make sure I'm not throwing rocks, that I'm not breaking windows. I have to make sure that I'm thinking kindly, that I'm peaceful, that I understand how Christ would behave, that I call myself Christian with meaning, and that you then follow the example of Christ yourself. And when we read in 1 Corinthians 11, in the light of those thoughts in 1 Corinthians 10, what our forefathers went through, we can make sure that we are overcoming society that is surrounding us. The society is failing. The famines, the temptations to deny Christ, the fornication that we see around us, the false worship, it is just everywhere. And while you might be kindly inclined, and you're never kneeling before an obelisk, what do we kneel before metaphorically? So when you read the Bible and your children read the Bible with you, remember that there's a lot of evil examples in here of what not to do. The examples are for our admonition to change our lives today. It is changing our lives today that is so important, because tomorrow we will take the Passover, and that is for our eternity.